Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I hear the sirens. There are shots being fired all over the internet today. We are in the middle of what I would consider to be an NBA Twitter war zone, wouldn't you?
What did I tell you, man? We closed off the pod last time, and I said, now we're getting back to the real NBA. The offseason is here. Everyone's talking trash, throwing shots back at each other. We had full-fledged Instagram beef today. I love it. I was walking around outside. It was perfect weather in D.C., and I looked down at my phone, and there was Draymond in that shirt, the quickie shirt. And then 15 minutes later, there was the LeBron Instagram. And then I think my favorite part was the Westbrook like on there, because I think LeBron and Draymond are actually like friends, like on the super low. And so I think they're sort of playing up the beef a little bit more, and it's mostly just jokes between those two guys. But it's not jokes with Westbrook. And so I liked him injecting himself into this somehow.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I was a little mopey yesterday. You know, I did my annual ritual of watching one baseball game because I was like, what else am I going to do with my life? The season's over. And somehow I missed out on your advice, which is the offseason basically is as good as the season, if not better, especially after that playoff run, which you were pretty down on. I didn't dislike it as much as you, but maybe it dragged at times. The offseason, not dragging at all. I mean, we get Draymond Green out there with a quickie t-shirt. We get LeBron James clapping back at him, apparently over his sexual prowess. And we've got Draymond going back.
I was wondering how you were going to describe it. I'm really, you did not disappoint. Then
we got Draymond going back, you know, at LeBron. Over his male pattern baldness and, you know, apparent decision to shave off, to just give it up and to embrace his inner Mike. This is an unbelievable story. I mean, we knew the parade for the Warriors was going to have fireworks. We just knew that was going to happen. But even though Draymond wasn't quite as unhinged as he was 2 years ago, he still brought it for sure.
Yeah, well, we have to cover a couple different aspects of this meaningless drama that, like, to people who don't like basketball, they probably would hear us talking about this and be like, God, that is the dumbest sport in the world. I can't believe people care about that stuff. But it's hilarious. It really does signal the true start of summer for me. And so with Draymond, whatever you think about the Warriors, the quickie shirt was great because it's making fun of Dan Gilbert specifically. And I think, like, all of America can agree that Dan Gilbert sucks. And that might be the thing that sort of brings us back together, is making fun of him, especially if LeBron leaves and Gilbert's team is suddenly half as valuable. I think that would be a win for everybody.
Yeah, I think the other reason why it was a win from Draymond's perspective is that he was just completely transparent about how petty and how long he spent thinking of the idea. Like, it would not really have worked quite as well. Like, the execution wouldn't have worked if it's just like, oh yeah, my friend just gave me this shirt. It's like, no, Draymond, like, Andrew called this last week. He knew you had not forgotten the 3-1 tombstone cookies. He knew that haunted you all season long. He knew deep down that you were planning a revenge t-shirt. And what do you know? Biggest stage at the parade, 1.5 million Warriors fans around, and Draymond's got his entire team, not just him, but like basically his whole float, wearing matching Quicken Loans Arena disc t-shirts. That is next level, and he owned it. I mean, he just came right out and said, look, I'm petty. I've been planning this since Halloween. Come at me. And I think that's really, like, that's why it worked, right? If he had tried to play it off, there's no way people would kind of backfire.
Wait.
Be like, Draymond,
hold on. Before we go further, I missed that part. Those were custom made t-shirts?
Yeah. So he said that he had multiple ideas in the works for t-shirts. This was the one that they could get done. They originally had them printed up potentially for the Game 4 in Cleveland. And Roz, everybody's favorite sideline reporter, was doing the interview. And she's like, Draymond, like, that's really petty. Like, you've been planning this since Halloween. Are you serious? He's like, yeah, I'm petty. What do you want? Like, he just flat out, just transparently owned it. Was like, yeah, all I do all day during a 67-win season is think of ways to get back at LeBron. And, you know, you mentioned that they're friends.
Yeah.
I think Draymond thinks he's friends with LeBron. I'm not completely convinced that LeBron thinks he's friends with Draymond. Like, I think LeBron might be doing the business mogul thing of like, keep your enemies close, you know, and like, he knows that, look, he's going to have to sort of be dealing with this Warriors stretch here for the next few years. I'm not completely convinced it's a genuine friendship on that side. And you know, Draymond,
that's,
I mean,
no, that's a good theory. That's a good theory. LeBron is using Draymond as a pawn. That makes sense. I have to be honest. I'm team Draymond in all things and have been for several years now. And I kind of understand other people getting sick of him and finding him corny and finding him ridiculous. I get it, but I personally love him. And, he's by far my favorite Warrior, even though I love Steph and like, I actually like all of those guys individually, but Draymond is just so ridiculous and so over the top all the time that you can't help but appreciate him. The one I will say, I'm kind of bummed that he made those t-shirts. It makes it better.
It makes it better though. Come on.
It makes it better that he made them and brought them to game four. That's pretty amazing. But
hey, can I get your reaction to his quote though? When he went at LeBron during his speech, Draymond to LeBron. So his microphone cuts out mysteriously. And then he says these words, super team this, super team that. Oh, I never played on a super team. He's referencing LeBron's comment after game five. And then Draymond says, you started the super team, bro. What's your takeaway there?
My takeaway is that we've gotten like five or six emails about LeBron's super team comment. It's like a fixture on ESPN Daily. People need to chill. LeBron sort of misspoke. And I think it's a matter of semantics. Like, LeBron was certainly on super teams. He was not on a team like the Warriors. And that's a fair point to make. And everybody needs to just relax and move on. But it's like when people catch him in a lie or catch him in like a BS moment, all the haters pounce. All the people who have like hated LeBron for 10 years come back and call him like a BS guy and everything. And it just is like, whatever, man. I'm kind of past like fact-checking LeBron.
I hear you. And let me provide some context on his original super team quote after game five. It was kind of an awkwardly worded question. And LeBron was acting like he just wanted to blow that question off. And then after he gave his answer, he like looked around the room and it was supposed to have been his last question. He's like, does anybody else want to ask another question? Basically saying like, that question was so bad, I'm going to give you guys a do-over.
Yeah.
And so it was really hard to sort of comprehend in that moment specifically what he was trying to say. I guess what his takeaway is that he didn't ever feel like he joined a team that had already been completely built for him. I think that's sort of where he was trying to go with it, to kind of differentiate again between himself and Kevin Durant. Because I really do believe he feels sort of like you do about Kevin Durant's decision, is that it's kind of a shortcut. I mean, I think if you gave LeBron truth serum, that would be his takeaway.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You know what's interesting? LeBron is not quite there yet, but at some point he's going to transition into old man Kobe mode and just start firing off takes like every 3 days. It'll be like a Thursday in January, and he's going to give like a 3,000 word interview where he's cursing throughout and just keeping it 100 the entire time. And that'll be great. That like era of LeBron will be super enjoyable. Right now, he's still trying to be sort of diplomatic, and it's kind of boring.
Well, my final comment here about Draymond calling out LeBron is that I loved the exclamatory bruh at the end of his statement. Now, we got some emails, because I dropped a bruh on you on the last podcast. We got some emails referring to me as a D-bag, a few other things for using that kind of an exclamation. And guys, I understand that might not be worldwide slang. Like, everybody might not be okay to do that, but in California, people say it, and then people also say that ironically. I don't think Draymond's going around talking like necessarily in that same tone all the time to his friends and buddies. Likewise, I'm not. But if I need to underscore a point for Andrew, such as, you know, he's looking into the past rather than looking towards the future when it comes to these Warriors and this pairing of Kevin Durant and Steph Curry, I'm okay. I have the license to do that, as does Draymond. I co-sign the bruh.
All right, thank you for that cosign. And now, having just defended LeBron, I feel like we need to criticize a couple things here.
Uh-oh.
Because first of all, his joke, while being, it was a good dad joke, but it was pretty corny, man. I mean, like, I don't know if it was a knowing dad joke. Let me put it that way. So that's number one. My other thing, LeBron posting a workout video on like the second day of the offseason is a little bit thirsty. Like, chill out. We know you work hard. You don't have to Instagram story yourself work in your weight room.
Okay, well, I'm gonna beef with you on the second one. Look, Zero Dark 23 is hard to last through. Okay,
he's missed a lot of Instagrammed workouts.
Look, I need this in my life, man. If this is what it takes, like a corny shaved head, you know, rapping along to music in the weight room video, I just want him to ease back into it. I didn't want to wait for another month. And, you know, in terms of his comment to Draymond, yeah, it was, I mean, dad joke's a good way to put it. Also, remember how indignant he was? I'm a father of three. There's certain things you just don't say. Wouldn't one of the certain things that you just don't say to another man who is a father is that your performance in bed is not long-lasting enough? Like, wouldn't that also maybe be a little bit below the belt? I mean, isn't that the definition of below the belt? You can't perform in bed. Isn't that a below the belt
shot?
Can
we just
Seems do like it.
Can we do an entire podcast of you finding new ways to explain what he said about the quickie?
Look, my euphemism game is deep, okay?
Yeah. All right. One other thing here. Can we talk about, like, the end game that I'm interested in as the rest of the league sort of regroups after the Warriors? I really want Russell Westbrook and LeBron James to end up on the same team somehow.
Wow. I love it.
I mean, love it.
Remember
on,
when
right?
we had that one fan give us a dream scenario of like, what would Westbrook be like on the Spurs? I mean, if we're talking about ways to take down the Warriors, isn't it Westbrook, LeBron, and Kawhi on the Spurs together? I mean, wouldn't that be the ultimate revenge team?
Yeah. And it's not completely out of the question. What's Russ's contract situation?
That's going to be up for a big question this summer, actually, because he can get an extension again. So he could basically lock in for a crazy amount of money in Oklahoma City this summer. It seems like locally they expect him to do that.
Uh-huh.
If he doesn't do that, then the Thunder are right back on that hot seat where they sort of were last summer, where it's like, well, what do we do? What do we do? My guess is, though, he takes that money and run. I mean, you look at his style of play, the workload that he's shouldering, even though the minutes aren't that high, his usage is so crazy high that if you're his agent, you got to be telling him, look, if you're going to have a 45 usage or whatever it was this year, you got to get as many guaranteed years as possible, because at some point that wall's going to hit. And obviously if you're Oklahoma City, you give him every penny you possibly can because he's the whole team now. So I'm not sure if I see Westbrook entering into this stranded stars discussion, to be honest.
Let me dream. It's the first or second day of the offseason here. And I just, so honestly, this all goes back to All-Star Weekend. I talked about it a little bit at the time. I was at the Beats by Dre party on All-Star Saturday night. And like, I had no business being there, first of all. But we got in and basically there were two VIP sections on opposite sides of the room. On one side was Kevin Durant and DeAndre Jordan and Nick Young. And it was a kind of the not cool section. And then on the other side, there was John Wall, who was sort of off by himself. And then Russell Westbrook and LeBron James were basically joined at the hip for 2 hours straight, rapping every word to every song that came on. And I don't remember them being that close, is I guess what I'm saying. And then I think that they were bonded by this KD thing.
Oh, of course. The enemy of your enemy is your friend, right?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that one of the oldest things?
I don't know, man. It's just something to file away. It's like, Russ, you're right. The extension will sort of determine everything. But it would not surprise me if that becomes a thing down the line. And it'd be fun because they both desperately need the help. But anyways, we have a lot to get to today. We have a lot of questions.
So much.
What should we do? Do you want to talk about De'Aaron Fox for a minute?
Well, yeah, let's do that in a second. But first of all, let's just thank everybody who's sending the questions. I mean, this is not obligatory. Like, we're not just doing this because there's some script that we've got here. Like, Andrew and I have been sifting through your guys' emailed questions for hours trying to pick out the best ones. I'd say we got hundreds, Andrew. It's crazy. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Now is the time to send in your crazy conspiracies, your cool stories. We love them. But before we get to a deep, deep pack of great questions, hilarious questions, I got to tear apart this De'Aaron Fox story that you wrote, because first of all, it was not in a negative way, by the way. We want to dig in deep here. You got a lot out of this guy, man. Like, yeah. I don't know if you guys haven't seen it, go read Andrew. He was in California, sat down with De'Aaron Fox. They did a little video about it. And Andrew kind of did a numbered type story in terms of going through piece by piece, kind of just to preview Fox, to talk about some of his shortcomings of his game, to talk about his personality, talk about the positive of his game. Obviously, this guy is going to be a top five pick. I think everybody agrees. But give me your quick takeaway from it. I mean, reading it, I kept thinking, wow, Andrew really loves this kid.
Yeah, well, basically what happened with that piece is we spent the day together and there was a lot of downtime where we kind of just like were catching up and shooting the shit. And it was fun, and there was a bunch of stuff that I just didn't want to cut. So we ended up doing more of a kind of everything was sort of loosely connected in there, and it was fun, man. I guess I would compare him to Fultz and say that Fultz is a more complete player and probably more polished at this point. But you could tell with De'Aaron Fox that like a year at Kentucky really made a difference with him, because he was super comfortable and at ease with himself, at ease with the media, and he's just a charismatic dude. Like, as we'll see on the court, I didn't want to oversell it in terms of what he can be, because it really is it's just a complete crapshoot. In terms of how his jumper develops, he really sort of underscores how little anyone knows about the draft. But as a person and as like a character, that dude is a star.
Okay, so here's a question I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned he's got a really high ceiling in the piece, and you also mentioned he's got kind of a low floor, right? Like, if somehow it doesn't work out, and the big knock on him obviously is his shooting, and you also mentioned his frame being pretty slight.
Yeah.
And you kind of threw out there like an Elfrid Payton comp for him.
Yeah.
When I read that, I wondered, isn't this guy physically, like, in terms of his speed, his quickness on the ball, like, aren't we pretty sure that even in a worst case scenario, he's going to be better than Elfrid Payton? I mean, it wasn't like, aren't there fewer questions about Fox now than there were about Payton when he was coming into the draft, if that makes sense?
Oh, definitely. Well, and Payton was older, I believe, and was coming from like Southeast Louisiana or something. And
I think it was Louisiana Lafayette. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a different situation. But the reason I mentioned Elfrid Payton is like, that was the comp I threw out 3 months ago. I said, basically the spectrum with him is somewhere between Elfrid Payton and John Wall. And I think a lot of smart basketball fans and smart people who talk about the draft look at him and see Elfrid Payton. They say, look, I just watched 6 months of NBA basketball where if you can't shoot, you basically aren't relevant anymore. And I've seen Elfrid Payton completely flatline in Orlando. So why should I believe that this guy can be any different? And it's a totally fair take, because if you can't shoot, I mean, I don't know. One question that came up along the way, do you think Rondo, like prime Rondo, like 2009 Rondo, would be as valuable in today's NBA?
No, definitely not. Another name that I was thinking of in terms of some of these comps, what about like a Moutier, you know?
Yeah. Moutier is a perfect example.
Because he was another guy where, and he didn't come in, I think, with some of the slightness of frame questions that maybe are hitting Fox, but he came in as like, okay, this is going to be kind of a powerful guy on the ball. He's going to be able to get to the basket. He's going to be able to be win his physical matchup. He can play either position defensively. You know, some of the things that you're mentioning about Fox, you know, potentially being able to be interchangeable and used alongside a point guard. And it just hasn't worked out at all for him, because mainly because of the shooting, but I think also because of the decision making. I mean, he had a lot of turnover issues and decision making problems in Denver. So I was wondering maybe if that was more the floor for a guy like Fox, even though they're built physically a little bit differently than Moutier, if, you know, the concerns people have about Moutier and his flatlining could be where we are with Fox in like year three. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I think you hit on it, though. The biggest difference between Fox and Moutier is that Fox is smarter and has better sort of basketball IQ, and is less of an apocalypse on defense. Like, Moutier is just kind of a mess. He's not really great at anything except like bullying his way to the rim, whereas Fox is actually good at a lot of different things. He's not, his passing will need to improve, but I mean, his whole season at Kentucky changed as his floaters in the lane started to fall and he became more of a real weapon on offense. And that was without the three. Without digging too far into the three, my theory on that is basically like it's famous now among my like draft nerd circles. He shot 21% from three. My theory on that, though, is basically that he lost confidence in his shot halfway through the year, and his solution was to stop shooting them. And he just didn't have enough attempts to keep his percentage from being like just miserable. And I think he's not a good 3-point shooter, but he's not a 21% 3-point shooter.
Yeah, that makes sense. When I was reading your piece, and I'll be honest, like whenever I'm evaluating a player from Kentucky, you know, a big part of my thinking is like, how much is this going to make Vivek salivate? And I only got about halfway through the piece and I was like, there's no way the Kings aren't going to get this guy. It's period. Like, it doesn't really matter what it takes. This guy is going to be a Sacramento King. And that's not even like a joke or like an easy punchline or whatever. I mean, you just think about where they are as a franchise. They need that John Wall turnaround type point guard, a guy who can build this thing from the ground up. They're in a position where they can wait on it for multiple years. They just traded Cousins. There's no expectations for them to win now. They've got a bunch of young core pieces kind of around them already. They could potentially get another guy if they can get him at five. They've got another pick where you can get that young, maybe that young backcourt. Or if you're convinced Hield is somehow part of that, then you can get another young piece, you know, maybe at the three spot, you know, to fill out at number 10. I mean, it just seems such a natural fit in terms of where they are as an organization, what they look for in guys, and what they need in terms of kind of like a face of this group. The kinds of concerns you have, you know, about his game, whether it's the body, the shooting, I mean, there's going to be issues for the first 2 years of his NBA career. There's no doubt about it. But I think those issues are easier to kind of sustain if you're in Sacramento, where you're at rock bottom, as compared to Phoenix, where, you know, you have this kind of pressure expectation to win now with a guy like Booker, kind of make the most of his development, or even, you know, Philadelphia, where I think there are going to be legit expectations on Philadelphia next season, given Embiid's play last year and given Simmons coming back.
Yeah.
To me, it just seems like a win-win-win for everybody if Fox lands in Sacramento. Am I missing something?
No, you're not. And that was the thing that caught me off guard, is they were all pretty into Sacramento as a possible landing spot. Philly is funny, because I even had Sixers fans responding to my piece being like, because I tweeted out a photo and he wasn't holding a Sixers hat. And they were like, thank God he's not holding a Sixers hat. So Sixers fans don't want De'Aaron Fox, and I'm pretty sure the feeling is mutual, because I was like, is there any team you don't want to go to? And he was like, yes, but we're not going to get into it right now. And we talked about every other team except for the Sixers. So, process of elimination, Fox is not a huge fan of the Ben Simmons era.
Look at that wordplay. The process of elimination.
Oh, okay, boy. Boy. Yeah, he also was kind of pumped that the Knicks did not jump in the lottery, because he said he did not want to live in Westchester and commute to New York City every day, which is a fair stance. But as far as what you said, like with the Kings, I kind of like where the Kings are right now, which is crazy to say out loud. But they're in a spot where they can add two guys, and yeah, we'll get to it later, because we had a question about the trade. I would consider trading up for De'Aaron Fox. They probably won't have to, but if they come away with two lottery picks in this draft and then suck one more year, they have their pick in 2018. That's a nice little foundation to build around.
Well, let's just get into that question right now, because I think that trade talk, or if it happens or not, is going to be one of the biggest things that happens on draft night. I guess I've kind of talked myself into the Lakers are trying to make themselves look like they're doing this whole due diligence, but they're going to come back to ball. You know, okay. I'm kind of just getting that personal vibe. Like, they don't want to make it look like they got strong-armed by LeVar, nor should they. But at the same time, I haven't really gotten the impression like they've got enough, seriously enough backbone to pass on him and deal with the potential short-term fallout of that.
Right.
Especially because it's going to be real difficult for them to get, you know, any real big impact makers this summer. So that's going to be a real tough time to get through if you're them. The easy pick for sure is taking Ball. I think they're going to do that. But they just want to make it look like they did their homework. So that leaves the next biggest draft day story as, do 3, 4, or 5 get traded, right? And we had a question about that, I believe.
Yeah. So the question was from Michael. First Sharp and now Simmons are convinced Sacramento will trade up with Philly to get number 3 for 5 and 10. I really don't think this is a good idea. Fox will fall to 5. Just believe in something for once. I'll ask the question again, though. What would it take for Sacramento to move up from 10 to 7 or 8? I don't think that's happening. The hope being that they can suddenly become Fox, Heald, Monk, and Scal as a core. Tank all year, let the rookies play, and then use their 18 pick. So the one thing, I don't think that Fox and Monk should play together again. After watching some highlights and talking to those guys, it's not that they're friends, but Monk will be better without Fox taking up touches and particularly pick and roll opportunities. And I think Fox will be better without Monk. So like recreating that Kentucky backcourt isn't quite as cool as it sounds. I think Heald is a much better fit with De'Aaron Fox. I understand why Kings fans want that 5 and 10 spot, but I really think that Fox is special enough and the type of guy who has the force of personality to make that team less miserable than it's been for the last 10 years.
He's hope, right? I mean, I think that's kind of one of the takeaways I had from your piece is the personality, the swag, whatever you want to call it, the confidence to just call out LeVar Ball in print and not care, but not be over the top about it. You know, just seem kind of genuinely confident.
Yeah.
That is the kind of guy that can really rally a fan base. And I think when you've got a distinct style of play that's exciting as well, you put those two elements together. To me, that's more than actually like skill set packages. That's where the wall comparisons make sense, right? Because, you know, rewind to when the Wizards got that number one pick and they were able to get Wall. That was like a gleeful moment for you, right? Like coming off a really tough time of Wizards history. And I guess it took a little while even more to play out, you know, to get rid of Arenas and all that. Yeah, but
it took another 5 years, but no, we got
not
there.
Not that long, but no, there was a transition. I mean, Wall didn't do it from day one, but he gave you kind of a hint right off the top about what that team could be. And to me, that's where Sacramento is. If I'm the Kings, I try so hard not to trade, you know, either one of their picks. I would not do a 2-for-1 to move up.
Yeah.
I think he's going to be there at 5. That'd be just my personal guess. Or if you do have to make a trade, like, because, you know, Philly's extorting you for 3, like, just trade one of your other young assets. Don't trade that pick. But I would try even harder to not use that second pick on a young Euro big. Just resist, Vladdy. Like, you can't do it. You just have to resist. You can't do it again.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's the smart play in all sports is always to hoard draft picks and not mortgage a couple different assets for one potential savior. That's never a good idea. But Fox, I just have a feeling, and I understand it does, like, a lot of smart people don't agree with me. But I thought this even before I sat down with him, and then he was that impressive. The one thing I really enjoyed from the story was his dad talking about Boogie. Did you get to that part?
Oh yeah, of course.
So the trainer was like, basically his dad said, yeah, like, Sacramento's cool. We can do it. We can do Sacramento. And Scal came in and played good once Boogie left. And then his trainer, Chris Gaston, says they were all scared of Boogie. Every last one of them players. He used to punk everybody. And then his dad is just sitting there rolling his eyes like, man, me and Boogie would be going at it. Fuck that. You got to be winning if you're with Boogie. And he went on from there. I didn't put it all. There was a little Boogie rant. They like Boogie, but they would not have tolerated him in certain circumstances. So bottom line is, it really is funny how much better Sacramento's future looks without Boogie. And that was one takeaway. And then the other thing that I, as far as Fox is concerned, before we move on, so he's been compared to John Wall constantly. Other people have thrown out Mike Conley. Tony Parker is sort of a curveball comp that actually makes some sense. Fox compared himself to Nick Van Exel, which I loved because I love any Nick Van Exel mention. But the comp that I see and didn't want to write because I didn't want it to sound like hyperbole, but he really reminds me most of Russell Westbrook through that final 2 months at UCLA, where you started to see flashes of something crazy and a lot of people missed it. Sam Presti didn't, but a lot, like, Russ was a reach at three when the Thunder took him. And there's an element of that with Fox. Like, he is a freak athlete who struggled for most of this Kentucky season until he took over for the final 10 or 11 games with Kentucky this year. So that's the only thing. I think that people sort of don't when they debate Fox the player, they're not necessarily talking about that guy.
Got you. Real quick, just give me the short and sweet answer on this. Are you ready to punt on the idea that he goes two to the Lakers? I know that was one of your pet theories or what you were kind of encouraging them to do maybe a month ago. Now that the process has played out, do you think he's in that conversation anymore or not?
I have no idea what the Lakers are going to do, but we should move to a Lakers question that I really liked. It's from Matthew. He says, this is why the Lakers shouldn't draft Lonzo and his fuckboy dad, and why they should instead draft Josh Jackson or Jason Tatum. What made the Warriors so good over the past couple of years? Plenty of teams have had great offenses, but it's the defense too. More specifically, the switching, right? So, he says, let's say the Lakers draft Josh Jackson this year instead of Lonzo. If they then go swing big and land LeBron and PG-13... this is what their starting five could look like. LeBron at the one, Brandon Ingram at the two, Paul George at the three, Josh Jackson at the four, and Julius Randle at the five. So that's what I'm wondering as we look at this Lakers pick is, first of all, I also think that you could slide Fox in there and he would make just as much sense and you just move everyone up a position. But bottom line, what I'm interested in is, like, I don't think LeBron wants to come play with second year Lonzo, and Josh Jackson might be more enticing for in that conversation. So,
never change, Lakers fans. You're trying to build the most versatile lineup, just dropping two top 10 players on your own team from other organizations. Yeah, I get it. Like, that really should be what's driving this draft decision. Look.
Right.
I maybe have warmed slightly on some of the LeBron to Lakers talk since we last talked. I mean, I'm at least willing to think about it and through the possible implications. You can't make this decision based on who fits with LeBron if you're the Lakers. Come on.
No. You personally don't have to warm on the LeBron to Lakers rumors. The question is whether Magic is warming on the LeBron to Lakers rumors. And whether they are crazy enough to believe that that's going to happen. And they really might be. And that, I don't know. I think it's as they waver on Lonzo. Basically, if you draft Lonzo, you have a team full of 19-year-olds again. Josh Jackson is older. He's more physically developed. He can play right away. Lonzo is going to struggle for 2 to 3 years probably, because he's slight and it takes longer for guards to catch on. Fox is a little bit of the same story, actually. So it's we'll see. I am not sold on Lonzo at two, and but I am, to answer your initial question, I am sort of, I've made peace with the fact that Magic is not going to take Fox there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I meant by saying I can warm to the idea of LeBron getting there is, like, you can construct this reality where, yes, he wants to have a next narrative to roll out if he falls to Golden State again in next year's finals, right? Like, LeBron's always a guy who wants to be one step ahead. He doesn't want to get stuck in this rut where he loses to Golden State like 3 or 4 times in a row, and it really does start to kind of, you know, not damage his legacy, but just sort of, you know, clearly put him a cut below. I mean, he's always someone who wants to change the story before, you know, the negativity catches up to him, right? And going to, you know, being Hollywood LeBron, Laker LeBron, would be a great way to do that. I mean, imagine how many shoes he would sell as a Laker. It's pretty crazy to think about. Imagine how he could take all of his off-court ventures if he's in LA constantly. I mean, whether it's the headphones, the shoes, the entertainment company, the media stuff he's doing, all of it would be enhanced. I mean, there's no doubt. You can understand where that would come from. But this is not like a Lakers team that has a clean slate. They have 3 solid years of a lot of baggage, right? Like, they answer to the world's largest basketball fan base.
Yeah.
They're dealing with tons of angst. They're right at the beginning of the rebuild. And it's been really, really, really hard and disorienting. I mean, they were clearly not prepared for this, right? They completely thought they were going to always be able to just pull superstars out of their back pocket. And it hasn't happened for multiple years in a row. They've got to make progress this season. And for that reason, you can't take a player with that high of a draft pick where it's like, oh, the reason why they did it is because they're hedging on a potential move 3 years from now, or, you know, at best next summer. It's just not really how it works. And that's why I think,
I don't know if,
I mean, you can have that idea, but you can't go all in on it. And you can't go all in with your number 2 pick on that kind of a hope and a prayer. And I also think, you know, if you are going to draft Lonzo, I'm not even saying he's the best player at 2. I don't know this stuff that well.
Yeah.
But he's tradable. That's a guy you can move next summer. If LeBron's like, nope, sorry, I'm going to give you the Andrew Wiggins
That's
treatment,
a good point.
You're out.
That is a really good point.
You can always move Lonzo.
Yeah. Well, and the flip side of that is Josh Jackson is the type of player that other players overrate. So other people are going to look at him and be like, oh shit, Josh Jackson, like, they got him on the wing. Like, he locks down. Like, his defense is pretty overrated. But I can see them looking at him and saying, this is a piece that we can use to attract other people. But you're right that there's more value, because another team would look at Lonzo and say, all right, let's rebuild around him.
Well, can I ask you a quick question about Jackson?
Yeah.
I was actually, in my head, I was going to prepare one question about all of the lottery prospects hit you with today.
We're doing that next week. It'll be great.
Okay, we'll do that next week. But can I get a spoiler out of the way? Because I do have this question about Jackson.
Uh-huh.
He's the one guy who's got some, like, actual real red flags off the court, right? Like, I mean, he had an incident with the law, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's interesting. They're not really, like, criminal red flags, but there were a couple, like, weird scandals at Kansas where, I don't know the specifics enough to comment, but I remember reading it being like, this guy is not a criminal, but he seems like sort of a douchebag.
Yeah, I believe he was charged with a couple of different situations. And I don't know if there was something about property damage and
damage to another player's ex-girlfriend's property, I believe.
Yeah. And I think he threatened to beat someone or threatened to beat a woman at some point. I'm not bringing this up to smear him. I don't know the guy. I've never met him. I guess my question is, when I'm looking at the teams at the top of the draft board, the one that jumps out to me, and you've said this is, you think is the best fit basketball wise, I believe, is Phoenix, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is Phoenix also the team most likely to weigh that heavily, you know, the red flag stuff a little bit more heavily than other teams? Because remember, I mean, they're just coming off this Markieff Morris situation. They had a player get a quote unquote extreme DUI a few years ago. I mean, they've had a few other situations where the fan base kind of turned on the organization because of players' poor behavior. And obviously a guy like Booker brings a lot of fans back, right?
Uh-huh.
But if you're a young, unproven GM, who's had some serious locker room issues where, you know, Coach Hornacek basically gets run out of there. You know, I mean, it was pretty ugly, that one situation, towels being thrown, so on and so forth. Can you stomach that red flag? Can you sell that red flag? Or is it the kind of situation where even though he fits well, you're a little bit more cautious than other teams? I guess that was one question I had. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, and I can't speak to his character. I don't know. His flags are firmly orange. I don't know if they're red, is my response to your question. If they were red, I would think that maybe a team like Phoenix might show more caution, but he's just ambiguous enough in terms of his behavior that plenty of teams are going to be able to talk themselves into it. And I don't think it's going to stop anyone from drafting him. But
gotcha.
That's a good question, because it's definitely something I've thought about, and it hasn't really been discussed very often in any of these draft conversations. So I'm not a huge Josh Jackson fan. A lot of people are, and it doesn't make sense to me. We did have one emailer who laid out the case for him as well as I've seen. And Eric says, with everyone out there dying to draft the next Draymond Green, I'm wondering why nobody has realized that player is right there in front of us. Josh Jackson from Kansas. Just like Draymond, he's a 3-4, maybe a 5 in a real small lineup, who can post up, play on the perimeter, move without the ball, good handles, excellent passing, high IQ, and awesome motor. The dude is lurking like Ronnie mother effing Lott in the backfield, waiting to jump into passing lanes, slide over to help teammates, take charges, contest shots at the rim, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm always a sucker for a good NFL comparison for any player. The two reasons I'm skeptical of Josh Jackson is, number one, well, there are a couple things. Everything that was listed there, he's not as good of a passer as people say. He's not as good a defender as people say. He is a terrible shooter. His jumper was decently effective at Kansas and won't be as good in the NBA. So that right there is sort of what differentiates him from Draymond. Draymond is capable. I'm not sure Josh Jackson will be. And then the other thing is, shooting, passing, and IQ, but his handles are a little bit overstated. I don't know. He can help a team as an additional piece, as like a secondary piece. But anything more than that, I think people are going to be disappointed.
Yeah, the Draymond comps get very difficult, guys, because it's easy to say versatile defender, great motor, he's Draymond Green, can play multiple positions, he's Draymond Green. Guys, remember, Draymond is an elite playmaker. At the beginning of last season, I said, you know, he's going to lead this Warriors team in assists. He's not going to shoot nearly as much. He's going to sort of be not full-time point guard, but definitely point forward. Those skills are so rare. To get those offensive skills in the same player with his defensive skills, that's why nobody's been able to find the next Draymond Green. So Draymond's passing to me and the playmaking and the vision and the basketball intelligence is what gets undersold with him still. And I think that's why he's a really dangerous person to comp to in these situations. I get very skeptical. Anyone who says, oh, this guy's the next Draymond Green, or he's got Draymond tendencies, it's like, okay, well, let's slow that train down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just... it's more with Jackson specifically. I mean, how much have you seen him play? Probably almost none, right?
Not too much.
Yeah. Well, if you watch him shoot a jumper, it does not inspire confidence. Whereas with Fox, you could watch him shoot and he's actually okay. Josh Jackson's all over the place. So it's rough.
Well, yeah, I would say, though, I mean, for Draymond, like, there was jumpers during the finals where I thought maybe there was an earthquake, like, in between the time he took it and the time it got to the rim, because it was, like, so badly offline. So
that's true. We have one more question related to Draymond, actually, that is a pet peeve of mine. So Brendan says, on Tuesday, Ben said, while naming the All-NBA teams, Draymond would be included, quote-unquote, if we're taking into account defense. I don't understand this phenomenon in the NBA. Defense is half the game. Of course it should be taken into account. In fact, it should count for about half of a player evaluation. So we got another question about pet peeves. We probably won't get to today. This is my pet peeve. I hate when people say that defense is half the game. It's not in the NBA. It just isn't. Like, in a league where everybody can score and everybody is explosive on offense, that, like, defense isn't as valuable. And there's an exception with Draymond, Rudy Gobert, and Kawhi because they are so dominant that they really do affect people. But for the most part, it's not. I don't know. Harden is more valuable than someone who's locking people down.
Yeah, just to quickly clarify, I responded to this guy, and we're on the same team here, Brendan and I. The reason why I say if we're taking into account defense, the reason why I say that is because if I don't, we get 50 emails from people who say, well, this guy averages more points than Draymond. How come you don't think he's a better player than Draymond? So it's like we have to remind people constantly that defense does matter. You and I have disagreed about this before. You think defense is overrated. I still think defense is underrated by the vast majority of fans. Now, I can tend to agree with you. Basketball Twitter or, you know, the intelligentsia might slightly overrate defense, but the overall general conversation of fans still completely underrates defense. And
that's,
you know, we've gotten that from people where, like, you know, I'll say, you know, Draymond's all NBA second team. I think that's where I put him this year. And people have told me I'm crazy. Look at his stats. And it's like, well, you're not telling me to look at his stats. You're just telling me to look at his points per game. Okay. And that's where I tend to try to clarify those things just to head those people off. Your biggest takeaway point, I think, is that if you're an elite offensive player and you get by on defense, you hold your position on defense, that is more valuable than being an elite defensive player and holding your position on offense.
Yeah.
You know, it's the difference between Harden and Roberson, right?
Right. Elite offense beats them every time. And even last year in the Spurs Thunder series, KD beat Kawhi and was more valuable than Kawhi. And that would have been true if Kawhi had been healthy this year. Although granted, like, Kawhi was completely overmatched, but like, that's sort of what I mean, is that great defense can only do so much.
Yeah. And that was what I was trying to say, is like, the market agrees with you.
Okay.
If Harden's this elite offensive player and he's average on defense or slightly below average on defense, I think he's getting closer to average, even though probably not quite there. You compare him to Roberson for Oklahoma City, who is an elite all-NBA defensive caliber player, but his offense is real broke, right? There is no question that when you compare the sizes of their contracts, once Roberson gets paid this summer, Harden is going to be valued by the market like double, maybe even triple what Roberson gets, right? So it's not a perfect comparison, but the NBA decision makers agree with you. And the only way you can be like a max level defensive player is if you're, you know, a player like Rudy Gobert, where it's just like so off the charts that you can lead like a top five defense basically by yourself, no matter who's around you. And that's getting trickier and trickier to quantify because, you know, let's say the Jazz somehow make the Western Conference Finals next year. Like, is he staying on the court? If Golden State goes to KD at center, like, is he still on the court? That's a question to me. I love Rudy Gobert, but that's an open question. And
right.
So it's getting tougher and tougher for those elite defensive guys to continue feel like, you know, money-wise and reputation-wise, they should be on the level as the same as elite offensive guys.
Yeah.
And that's a recent development. I mean, offense has never been more important. This was a historic offensive season across the board for lots of different teams. You look at Cleveland, Golden State, Houston, all ridiculous offenses. It was LeBron's best offense ever. Houston took basically more threes than anybody ever. Golden State had like the most efficient offense essentially since like the Showtime Lakers. The game has changed here these last couple of seasons, and it is tilting things towards the direction that you're arguing.
Yeah, and I'm not arguing that defense is meaningless, like, but it just is. It literally isn't half the game. It's like a 70-30 thing as far as the NBA is concerned. And so people who say it's half the game, it should be 50-50. No, it really shouldn't. But one interesting question for you: would you rather have Kyrie or Mike Conley if you were LeBron James in the finals?
I mean, are we taking into account like the experiences that they've had together? Are we giving Kyrie credit for the years they've already spent together? Or is this like a total vacuum?
Vacuum.
If it's a complete vacuum, I would say probably Conley, just because he's the more complete player. He's a really good on-ball defensive player, very smart, very consistent. But I think if we're not talking vacuum and we're saying, look, these guys have played together for multiple years, they know each other inside and out, they've got the chemistry built up, then I would lean towards Kyrie.
Yeah. See, that's sort of where you and I disagree. Is I think that if you put Conley in this past Warriors series, the Warriors are still going to get 115 to 125 a game, and then you're going to need someone to score 40, and Conley can't do that. And that's kind of a microcosm of the conversation in general.
Well, I would go back to saying, like, Golden State did really respect the job Utah did in the second round, right? I mean, they made it tough for him. There was parts of that series where they were sweating. It's just a different look. You know, if you put Conley in on that team in place of, like, the injured George Hill, I think that series gets even more interesting. Stylistically, the way that Cleveland's built this year, I mean, for that particular series,
yeah.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, if we're taking it back out as a vacuum, though, in general, I would rather have Conley, at least for, you know, this year and next.
Yeah, if they could have Conley and Paul George, I'd be sold. But you mentioned Utah. We should finish up here with Utah and the summer of Gordo, which I'm really excited for. So first of all, to follow up with Lindsay's question from last time, where does Utah go from here if Hayward leaves? And how likely do you think it is that he leaves right now?
Personally, I still stick by what I told the Salt Lake Radio guys a month ago. If I was Hayward, I would leave.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're in this era of got to get mine. You know, and people, like, you know, everyone makes fun of me for sounding like the old guy. You know, it's the I'm getting mine generation. I mean, that's where the NBA is right now. If you're not teaming up, you're falling behind. We've seen that from multiple high profile free agents in recent years, not just Kevin Durant, a guy like LaMarcus Aldridge as well. And you can throw LeBron into that, too. I mean, he did make that Kevin Love trade for a reason not that long ago. If I'm Hayward, even if you take out the Brad Stevens factor, Boston makes so much sense. The money difference is real, but not like completely overwhelming in Utah's favor. And I also think there's a better chance to him to get to the finals, depending on what happens with Cleveland here in the next couple of years, than there is to be in the West. You know, generally speaking, I call this like the Millsap route, because remember, Millsap was just kind of on the edges, the fringes of stardom, always overlooked, never really talked about when he was in Utah. Now he's still overlooked, but at least he's made a conference finals in Atlanta. At least he's been an all-star multiple times. It's just a lot easier in the Eastern Conference to do your thing if you're that type of player. And that's why I would go east if I was Hayward. It makes more sense to go to Boston than anywhere else. That's what I would do.
Man, the Millsap comp is such a good call. That if I were Miami or Boston, I would just be playing highlights of Paul Millsap running through the East. Because,
well, do you know who it really applies for?
Who?
Blake Griffin. I mean, you want to talk about saving your career and not having people talk about you're falling off a cliff athletically? Go play in the Eastern Conference. You're going to look like a freaking superstar.
Yeah, man. No kidding. Well, so what about Utah? Here's the thing. I don't think Utah will actually fall off as much as people expect when Hayward leaves.
Well, there's two comparison points. LaMarcus leaving Portland and Kevin Durant leaving Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. I think Hayward would fall and the Jazz would fall somewhere in between those two comparison points, right? Where you could kind of see them eking along, still making the playoffs, sort of like Portland did in the first year after LaMarcus leaves. It would be a much less entertaining team, even though the Jazz maybe aren't the world's most entertaining team right now.
Yeah.
But you would know you would have an elite defense. You'd just be scrounging whatever you could possibly do on offense. You'd probably try to turn Burks into a bubble boy. You know, you just give him whatever kind of...
I have no idea what that means.
No, you've seen the bubble boys. Like, you know, when you're young and, like, you can't be exposed to the environment, so they put you in, like, a protective bubble.
Yeah.
Well, Burks has had trouble staying healthy. So, like, you would just need to pray that Burks could be a bubble boy.
Okay.
And then Hood would become the guy. You'd be able to pay George Hill, and you'd try to run it back, and you wouldn't be as good as this season, but maybe you don't fall off a cliff. I mean, Hayward isn't quite as important to the Jazz as KD was to the Thunder.
Right.
So I don't think that they would fall that far, but there'd be a big hit because their offense just relies so heavily on him. And because he was really, really good this year. I mean, of all the guys to leave off the All-NBA team, he was right up there with the toughest guys to leave off. I thought he was a worthy snub, but still, that's a serious talent that Utah just couldn't replace. I mean, they're not going to be able to go out and draft or trade or sign a Gordon Hayward replacement. I mean, that is the kind of move that totally changes your trajectory as an organization.
You know, I just remembered a couple months ago, we were doing this podcast and you went on like a little 2-minute monologue about Gordon Hayward. And
Sounds like me.
I remember staring up at the ceiling being like, oh my God, we need to just get through the dog days of the regular season. But you're right. He was good this season. He's, you know, I think with Utah, the story would be that he losing Hayward lowers their ceiling, but they still have a pretty high floor because their defense is awesome. And hey, I have yet to give up on Dante Exum. And there's always a chance that he sort of leaps forward and things get interesting. I'm not a huge George Hill believer. Wouldn't give him $80 million, but they might have to. But Hayward leaving is not a crisis for them. I honestly, if they could sacrifice Hayward or Gobert, I would sacrifice Hayward.
Yeah, I don't see it that way necessarily. I mean, I think that Gobert is more irreplaceable for them. So I guess I sort of agree with that part of it. But I do think it would be the kind of organizational crisis in terms of like you had this guy, you built him all the way up into his prime and then he leaves for nothing. That's not an easy bump for a small market team like that to get over. I think it would also be real crushing for the fan base because they had so much positive momentum coming into the playoffs this year. So it would really slow, I think, trust in belief in that front office. And when I look at the assembled pieces, like even if you give Exum a step forward, even if you take your advice and say, okay, don't pay George Hill, the remaining pieces there are bottom 10 offense, right? I mean, pretty much no matter what. And that's tough. I mean, that's going to lead to some really tough nights where, you know, if the defensive intensity isn't there, or if you have an injury like they've had so many of in recent years, you know, they're getting smoked by a lot of these teams in the West that just have these elite offenses.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the other side of this then, because Utah can get a little grim if we spend too much time on the Jazz post Hayward. But Trey says, do you think that Pat Riley is smoothly making his way to Gordon Hayward under the radar as always? He's been saying that he plans on signing the 16-17 Heat team back because of how historical the second half of their season was. But with Bosch cap relief, he could make a big move toward Hayward and possibly either keep mini LeBron James Johnson, or really talented J.R. Smith, Dion Waiters. A new big three in Miami with Hayward, Dragic, Whiteside, like the most underrated big three in the NBA because the Heat don't play around one guy, which is perfect for Gordon Hayward. What do you think? I'm not totally sold on Hayward as being that realistic for Miami, but where are you on it?
I think he makes way more sense for Boston, but I just gave like a 5-minute long detailed nuanced take on Utah, and I'm going to give you 10 seconds on Miami, okay?
Okay.
I think the key question for both Hayward and Blake Griffin is, do those guys really want to play with Hassan Whiteside on this max deal, right?
Right.
Period. Like, do you want to go to a team where he's clearly entrenched as that guy? That he's been this big question mark these last couple of years. You know, he goes from the minimum to the maximum. He's doing all these funny things on Snapchat with DJ Khaled or whatever. I mean, is this really a guy who's going to lure free agents who people aren't going to be turned off by? I think that's my question, you know, and we know Miami's a destination, but is Miami with Whiteside as a central guy a destination? And I think that raises a secondary question, which is, if you're Pat Riley, are you trying to move Whiteside to really be a player in free agency this summer, right? Like if you can have Blake Griffin and you can trade Whiteside out to somebody else and then bring in somebody else to support Blake Griffin and roll forward with Dragic and some of these other guys that you mentioned, is that your play? I think that's on the table.
That is really interesting. The Heat, I feel like they've been low-key open to trading Whiteside forever. Oh, like, yeah. The entire time he's been there. So yeah, that is, I hadn't thought about that. The other thing is, I don't know. I mean, I understand that everyone around the Heat loved the second half of this season, and it was sort of a powerful experience for everyone involved. I'm still not sure I would buy in on the next 4 years of Dion Waiters.
Yeah, no, I've never ever bought in. I think people who celebrate him on Twitter are silly.
I haven't even bought in. He is like, he's too on brand for me. He's too much of a bucket getter. I can't deal with it. I loved his Players Tribune piece. And I love Chris Ryan, who is like the Dion Waiters stan of all stans. But I just can't get down with Waiters as like a serious option for a potential contender in Miami.
Yeah, I've been good on Dion Waiters the whole way. I'm still good on Dion Waiters. And I guess if that's part of the question too, you know, if you're reconstructing your organization, who do you pay if you're Riley? I mean, you definitely would part with, to me, you'd part with Whiteside and or Waiters if it means you can get a Hayward or a Griffin.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really want to reimagine this thing and retool it a different direction, those guys were nice pieces last year. They're giving you numbers. They are good, you know, at least decent backup plans if things fall through, but they're not even close to untouchable, even though, you know, Dion Waiters was trying to tell everybody, this is my city, after he made like one 3-pointer his entire life.
Yeah, I don't want to hate on Dion Waiters. I just am not prepared to love him either or put a ton of faith in him. But the most interesting part of this to me is that I don't know if Gordon Hayward makes that much sense in Miami, but I love that Miami might want him and that we might get Pat Riley and Danny Ainge going head-to-head for the premier free agent this summer, because that is one of my favorite rivalries in the NBA.
That's a great point. I'll take Team Danny on this one. I know I've been mocking Danny's fans for like months, but I think I'm going Team Ainge.
Really? Okay. That's fair. I would remind you, earlier today I was looking up the Pat Riley letter to him, which came, I guess, was that during the playoffs?
I don't remember the exact circumstances around it, but please, like, let's reminisce.
Well,
go ahead.
He released a statement saying Danny Ainge needs to shut the F up. I'm bleeping it out. The statement didn't. Danny Ainge needs to shut the F up and manage his own team. He was the biggest whiner going when he was playing, and I know that because I coached against him. And that was the whole statement released through an official team spokesman. I think it was maybe during the middle of the playoffs. And
So it was in March 2013. So it was just before the playoffs, and I think people were probably anticipating another Heat-Celtics showdown, or maybe not.
Yeah, I guess so. The Heat and Celtics, that was like the tail end of Ubuntu. And then Ainge responded and said, I stand by what I said. That's all. I don't care about Pat Riley. He can say whatever he wants. I don't want to mess up his Armani suits and all that hair goop. It would be way too expensive for me. So what I'm saying is that the summer of Gordo is really about reigniting the Pat Riley, Danny Ainge blood feud. And who knows what happens. The other thing that I think is interesting is one of these teams is going to get stuck spending like $120 million on Blake Griffin, which is a pretty risky proposition, if you ask me.
You know, Ainge makes such a big deal about how he's got this Chipotle card for life, you know, where he can go in and get his free burritos for life. If there's anyone in the entire world who is unimpressed by a Chipotle gift card for life, isn't it Pat Riley? I mean, can't you just see him eating at Prime 112 every single night? Got a 72-ounce filet mignon, thinking like, oh, carnitas. Oh, you're going to try to blow me away with your unlimited carnitas. Okay, Danny.
Do you think Pat Riley has ever eaten a Chipotle burrito?
Heck no.
Oh my God. Hold on. Listeners don't realize you just said hell no and then went back to correct yourself to heck no.
Look, we've got some quality middle schoolers out there who are listening, okay? I just try to keep it PG for the young homies.
That's true. And I perpetual apology for letting various curse words slip. Yeah, well, Pat Riley, We should honestly look into that and ask whether Pat Riley has ever eaten it. I feel like we could get there. We're not Wright Thompson, but we could talk to people in Miami and find out. So maybe that could be a summer project for us. So the last question of the day, we're not going to get to like half of these, unfortunately. But the thing that came in last night, I was pretty tired. I was in the middle of trying to like put together that Fox story. And this email from Alex comes in and he says, so the other day I was at an escape room with my friends in LA. We were waiting in the lobby before our session started, and I started looking at some of the pictures of people who had previously done this escape room. And who do I see? Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, and Raymond Felton. My first reaction was that I would not want to be locked in a room with Chris Paul. My next thought was, who do you think would be the worst NBA player to do an escape room with, and who would be the best? I think the worst would probably be Rondo, because he would probably just try to solve all the puzzles by himself. I think Iguodala would probably be the best. He seems like he knows how to solve problems, and he clearly knows how to play unselfish. What do you think? So I have a lot of questions here. I emailed back asking what the hell an escape room is, and then you made fun of me. So I'm going to sort of cede the floor to you to explain this, because I have no idea what we're even talking about.
Okay, so I can't even really explain it that well. I've just heard of them before, and you hadn't heard of them, which kind of blew my mind. But I think it's sort of like, it might be like 21st century laser tag, right? Where it's something that like adults and kids can both do. I think it's more like adult-oriented entertainment, where like if you're not willing to stoop to like mini golf to embarrass yourself, you can go to these kinds of places and have a little diversion. I think it's also kind of getting into the crossover territory of like charades and Trivial Pursuit. You know, it's like trying to get at, you know, people who are, you know, Scrabble nerds, chess players, like, you know, trying to tap into that market. But basically you go to this place, you get put into a room, and you can't either get out of that room or get onto the next puzzle until you solve some sort of a conundrum. So it's kind of like an Amazing Race, but without the 75,000 travel miles built in and the weird language barriers.
Okay.
Is that good enough of an explanation or no?
Yeah, totally. I mean, when he sent the
email... It's timed. The key thing is that it's timed. Like, you're not going to get stuck in there for 5 hours, right? But like, you have a certain amount of time to get through this like sort of maze type of thing. But it's a mental maze. It's not really a physical maze.
Okay. Well, when he sent the email, an escape room was in the subject line. And for some reason, I associated that with panic room. And like, I was imagining that this was all going to be a metaphor for like where the Clippers are right now. Because Chris Paul is sort of in an escape room with them. Because like, they've got the $200 million deal. He can't really get out. And he's kind of just stuck in this awful spot.
So you were picturing like straight jackets and like who was going to gnaw your arm off so that you could get out of your hell?
Yeah.
I mean, is that basically what it was?
Yeah. I thought this was all an elaborate Clippers joke. I didn't think escape room was a real thing. But having listened to your description, I think that Rondo would be top five in terms of people to be in an escape room with, because he is sort of a savant in terms of solving the weird mind game puzzles and everything else. I think he'd be really good. Iguodala, he's a great basketball player. He is someone that I feel like might get on my nerves if I had to be around every day, because he's so just pretentious enough to be a little bit annoying. Whereas Rondo is kind of an asshole, but you at least know exactly where you stand every day.
Well, I thought his picks were out of this world good. When I read the email, it annoyed me because I was like, those are excellent picks. I hear what you're saying on Iguodala. I do think, I mean, intellect is the key, right? And like thinking on your feet.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I think of when I think of Iguodala. I think I've got, so I really dug deep here to come up with some alternate answers, and I want to run them by you.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the worst, if it can't be Rondo, I think it's got to be Reggie Jackson. I mean, I would.
That's a great one. That's a really good one.
there is almost, I mean, okay, I have my price, but there's almost no amount of money you could pay me to be stuck in a room where we have to problem solve with Reggie Jackson, because you know he's blaming you right off the top,
well,
no matter what.
Like, no, you don't know. I don't know why everybody doesn't like Reggie Jackson, but everybody hates Reggie Jackson. So we need more details on what exactly makes him so unbearable on a daily basis, because he's now had two teams basically turn on him.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, my favorite word, accountability. I think that's going to be an issue. I think pouting has clearly been a problem. And those are just not things when you're trapped in a confined room. Like, think about it sort of like, who would you want to be on a flight with if for part of the flight you had to like figure out how to run the autopilot and like fly the plane, right? I mean, that's sort of my comparison point. And there is almost no one I would rather be my co-pilot less than Reggie Jackson. Like,
that's a great pick. That's a great pick. Who else do you have?
Okay, and my pick for who I would want to do it with, and look, I'm going to just take an exemption here. He's not a current player, but bottom line, the number one answer all time, Tim Duncan. There is no better escape room person. First of all, Tim Duncan, there's like a 75% chance he designed the escape room. We don't know what he does in his free time, but it's very possible. Second of all, he's never going to get down. Like, no matter how many times you screw the puzzle up, maybe you get the pieces backwards, maybe you misread the clue, whatever, he's never going to get down on you. He's always going to pat your head and say, it's okay, it's okay. He's an incredibly intelligent, intellectual type thinker, and he's just a winner. Like, there's no way you're coming out of the escape room without setting the all-time escape room record if Tim Duncan's on your team. You're just going to be the best. So the number one would be Tim Duncan. Least would be Reggie Jackson. I'm very comfortable with my answers. I actually think I beat his answers, even though his answers were great.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't prepare for this one as much. so I don't have anything groundbreaking to say here.
Go ahead.
I don't have a Reggie Jackson.
Just go ahead and dump on Tim Duncan. We know that's what you want to do.
No, I'm not even going to acknowledge it, because I don't want to come off as a Tim Duncan hater, but I do roll my eyes every time people start gushing about Tim Duncan. But Chris Paul would be the worst to me, because I think Chris Paul would put stress on me and everyone else in there that would make the job a lot more difficult and certainly not fun at all. But also would you, like, everybody would be freaked out and on edge the entire time. Whereas, again, I got to come back to Rondo. I think that Rondo would just do everything himself, and that's fine with me. I don't have any desire to solve puzzles to get out of these escape rooms. I don't necessarily understand the appeal.
Yeah, it's pretty weird that I'm not really into this, to be honest. Because like the escape room sounds like my ideal hobby. One other thing that I would say is like the 405 freeway basically is an escape room. So it's weird to me that escape rooms are so big in LA when everybody complains about the traffic being like the worst part about it, being stuck and being confined. And then that's what they go do for fun, is like get stuck and confined and have to like make up these incredibly difficult decisions. It doesn't seem like a real break from your reality. It just seems like another depth to the same thing.
Yo, hold on. Speaking of the 405 freeway, we completely forgot to discuss Jerry West today. Which I know that I was reminded of that because of Jack McCollum's story, and which included the line that Jerry West can't wait to get back to LA, where he's one of his hobbies is finding surface roads to avoid the 405. So it's kind of messed up that we spent the first 15 minutes of this podcast discussing Instagram comments and completely ignored one of the greatest players and probably the greatest executive in NBA history. But give me your 2-minute take on Jerry West.
Well, look, if this summer goes really well for the Clippers, it's going to be a home run hire in terms of addition to their front office. You knew Ballmer wasn't going to take that loss lightly. I mean, it was a pretty tough loss for ownership. And if this summer goes terribly, I mean, Jerry West might start at the two. I mean, that's really where the Clippers are.
Perfect. That's all we need. That is all we need. Good luck, Jerry.
I mean, honestly, like,
totally.
Like, if they lose Redick, if Griffin bounces, if they have to pay Chris, then, you know, there's a shot that you're looking at Chris Paul and Jerry West in the backcourt.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to end the podcast. All right. next week, we're coming back. We'll probably record on Monday afternoon. And I want to talk about my big board. I'm giving you a homework assignment. You need to look into these draft prospects. I'm not going to tell you who to look at. I just want you coming back on Monday with takes and questions. And we will go over, we'll spend 40 minutes on draft and then do 20 minutes of questions at the end. And I think I'll probably see you in New York next week. So it's going to be fun.
Awesome. Yeah, I am going to have one question about each of the top 14 prospects for you. Some might be detailed, some might be nerdy, some might be jokes, but I will have one question for each of the top 14 players. So you better be ready. You better do your homework too, okay? I'm coming strong on Monday. You better be ready for it.
Okay. All right, man. Well, yo, enjoy the weekend. You upgraded your drone recently, so I'm waiting for some pictures, and I will talk to you soon, all right, man?
Sounds great. Hey, guys, openfloormail@gmail.com. Send us your stories, your questions, your proposed questions for Andrew about the draft, because, look, he's the expert. We're going to dig in deep on that stuff. Be sure to give us those 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. We're doing great on there. We appreciate your support. Look, we're not going to take off just because the season's over. We're still going strong. We'll hope you'll stick with us. Andrew, be sure to tell the people where they can follow me on Instagram, Ben.Golliver. I'll talk to you next week.
Peace.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.